This is Worm Country, a place where men and women make their living by plucking slimy creatures out of the muck.
You know, that clip makes absolutely no sense out of context, but I kind of thought it described what we do here at Playback, plucking 25-year-old stories from the murky depths of the NPR archives. Fortunately for us, most of these stories aren't slimy in the least. We're traveling back in time to witness the legendary worm digger strike of June 1984. I kid you not. And we'll also hear critical reaction to the release of Bruce Springsteen's album, Born in the USA.
I don't quite hold with this British kind of idea that every record ought to be a complete departure from the last one.
Rock critic Dave Marsh and NPR's Noah Adams offer their first impressions of what would become one of the most well-known albums of all time. And we'll have an interview with one of the most famous ducks of all time. What he's trying to say is...
That means I love you, give me a kiss.
Stay tuned as Rene Montaigne fends off the charms of a man who lent his voice to a duck named Donald. And in June 84, it had been 40 years since Allied forces had landed on the beaches of Normandy.
There were miles and miles of rows of tanks, of M4s, M5s. It was just unbelievable.
We'll have a special format-breaking story about the D-Day invasion from NPR's Clem Taylor, with stories from three men who were there. And we continue the now time-honored tradition of our trademark top-of-the-show montage as some seriously underage constituents reveal who they would vote for in the fall presidential election.
I would vote for Ronald Reagan because he thinks that you should work for what you have, and I agree with his military buildup because I don't want to be invaded by the Soviet Union.
I don't know who I really would pick, but I surely wouldn't pick Ronald Reagan. He makes the rich people richer and doesn't give nothing to the poor.
I'd vote for Mondale. He's got experience and everything. And hard, I hate.
I'd probably vote for Jackson, Reverend Jackson, because the black president hasn't been, elected yet, so it'll be a big difference and probably better because, you know, he's a reverend and everything.
And you really can't trust a lot of presidents. You can't count on their word, none of them. I think Gary Hart, I think he's the only president because, like, when he talks, he says good things, but you can't trust nobody.
I would vote for myself because I think I would be a good president.
My uncle, because he will keep the laws good, prices low, and will help other people.
Well, I would like Michael Jackson because he's cool and really cute and all this stuff. And he would be able to sing to us, like, instead of just talking like all the others would.
Singing president, not a bad idea. Though, if pressed, I might go for that Andrea Bocelli guy or maybe even Susan Boyle. But I guess they hadn't showed up on the radar in 1984. And as it was June, and NPR had already covered the waterfront with lots of Mother's Day stories, it was Dad's turn. Here's NPR's David Malpas.
You don't have to be an expert on social trends to know that being a father today is a lot different than it was 20 or even 10 years ago. The rapid rise of two-career families and the desire of many men to take a more active role in fathering has led to a new generation of fathers, and to a new generation of problems for men trying to balance the conflicting demands of career and family. A few days back, I talked with three men who have firsthand experience. Stephen Carson is 44. He lives in Chicago and has two children, a 16-year-old girl and a 10-year-old boy.
When my kids were being born in their early years, Dr. Spock and that whole range of psychologists came out with all kinds of baby books, and while I read a lot of them, I still raised my kids by the seat of my pants, and so far they've turned out very well.
So often I think fathers in the past left most of the child-rearing responsibilities to their wives. Dad provided a home, financial support, perhaps taught us how to play baseball or something about hunting. But we were probably closer during our childhood to our mothers. Is that changing for this new generation? Do you make a point of spending more time with your kids than your fathers did with you?
I think that being a father now is the greatest commitment that probably most men can make. And I think that marriage used to be that kind of a commitment. But marriage now is not seen that way. And it's a lot easier to say, okay, we'll try that again. And the second thing is that 20 years ago, you know, fathers could have children and be quite distant from them. Now we don't. Now we share it, and it's a much greater commitment than it used to be.
Stephen, your children are older, 10 and 16. Have your ideas about your responsibility toward them and the amount of time you want to spend with them changed over the years?
Well, I've always wished that I could have spent more time with the kids when they were younger. For the most part, I've always had to work two jobs, not to make ends meet, but so that we would have what used to be considered luxuries and are now considered necessities. I think it's important, especially when kids are young, that they know that you're around in case something happens. They have somebody to go to, and it's not just the mother.
I think many of us who are younger fathers today like to think that we are developing closer ties with our children and spending more time with them. But with the pressure of careers and both parents working, I wonder if we are really treating our children better today than a generation ago.
Well, we wonder about it, too. We wonder if we're forcing them to conform to our schedule and taking away from them the calm period that I know I had when I was 3 years old. No one got me out of bed at 7 a.m. and said, hurry. Yeah, you've got to get some breakfast in you, and because we need to be to work. I've got a meeting this morning. And I don't think my father had as many of those tasks to perform. He could come home in the evening and play with us and enjoy us. So balancing your ambitions to grow in your career with your ambitions for your children is a tough part of it, too.
I always enjoy a little sensitive soul-searching. Really brings out that 25 years ago kind of feeling. And men and women equally sharing in child raising. That is a quaint idea. It just needs a little more time to catch on. And now, a word from our sponsor, Uncle Al. He's got some safety tips for those kids listening out there. And even I admit, this is absolutely odd. But it did air on NPR. So it's not like I made it up.
Can I be your uncle? My name is Uncle Al. I've many things to tell you, kids, so let me be your pal. Hey, Mom and Dad, may I talk to the kids a minute? I'm everybody's Uncle Al. And now, kids, now that the weather is changing, that means some of us will be playing ball. Well, it could mean danger, too, you know. The ball could roll into the street, and there are cars whizzing by. So don't follow it. Just let that ball roll. And you know, bicycles are also fun to ride. In the olden days, your great-grandparents rode on bicycles built for two, so that they had four eyes watching in all directions, so they could ride safely. There were very few cars then, and they drove much slower than the cars of today. So when you're riding, look from side to side and forwards too, just like airline pilots do. Well, I've got to hop on my bike now and play ball. So listen for your Uncle Al another day. I love you. When we sing together, songs are such delight. Harmony makes the melody right.
That was our kind and caring Uncle Al, also known as Al Lewis. He hosted the longest-running local children's television show in history in Cincinnati, Ohio. And since we're entertaining the kids, it's time to bring out that duck with a speech impediment. They called him Donald, but the man behind the duck-billed cap was a fellow named Clarence Nash. He spoke to NPR's Renee Montaigne.
Clarence Nash, a charming 79-year-old known as Ducky to his friends, has been the one and only voice behind the duck all these years. Back in the early 30s, Nash had been doing animal imitations as part of his vaudeville routine. Quite by accident, he remembers, Walt Disney happened to catch the act.
Well, Walt happened to hear me on a radio program. He was looking for a character that would be so different from Mickey, and I'm very thankful that Walt heard me that night. That's the only character that I know of where the voice came first.
The voice Nash was doing was supposed to be that of a frightened goat, but what was a goat to Nash was a duck to Disney, and Donald Duck was born. The first Donald Duck movie was released on June 9, 1934. Nash's personal favorite is Donald's second motion picture, Orphan's Benefit.
Because that's the one that really brought out his full personality, where he recited, "Mary Had a Little Lamb," and then he later on gave an applause. An encore, rather. He did this.
Little Mamu, to blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. McLaren is the boy, the new sack for the sheep.
He's under the haystack, fast asleep, you know.
That brought out his full character. And I never forget, when we went to that sneak preview, the audience began to howl, laugh. And I even laughed, too. Momentarily, I forgot I did the voice of Donald and laughed right along.
Donald's sputtering rages, his utter incompetence in the face of a continuing series of obstacles, had Depression-era audiences in stitches. About as different as you could get from the smiling and eager Mickey Mouse, Nash believes Donald appealed to the inept little guy most people try to suppress.
Well, he's very much like us. People can lose their temper. Of course, his is a little more trigger temper, Donald's a good moral character. He doesn't smoke, drink, or
cuss.
And two, he once in a while plays tricks. He gets a little bit in mischief once in a while. Of course, it comes back on him, and that's when he gets mad. He gets mad at himself, maybe. He speaks more languages than I do.
Could I hear some French, Donald Duck?
You know what he said? Je vous aime, moi, chérie, embrasse-moi. That means I love you, give me a kiss.
Clarence Ducky Nash says Donald has changed since he first began his career 50 years ago, but just a little.
He's become cuter in appearance, of course, and his vocabulary has increased.
Has he gotten older?
No, I never feel a day older. Never a day older.
That was NPR's very own Renee Montagne talking to Clarence Nash, the voice of Donald Duck. Yes, it's time for the story you've been waiting for.
There is a labor problem in the state of Maine in the multimillion-dollar worm industry that supplies bait for fishing up and down the east and the west coasts. John Rudolph reports.
A hot June day on the mudflats in Rockland, Maine. This is worm country, a place where men and women make their living by plucking slimy creatures out of the muck. Traditionally, this is the height of the worming season. But this year, things are a bit different. Worm diggers who would normally be hauling in 1,000 to 2,000 worms a day have gone on strike. The issue is money. Diggers want a pay hike from 4 cents a worm to 5.
We've all got together on a majority vote that we would stay out until we get our 5 cents, because it's been 6 years since we've had a raise. And the cost of living has gone up since then, and we're hoping that the shippers see our need, and they're putting a blind eye to it.
Jimmy Hammond has made a living digging worms for almost 20 years, but right now he's helping to coordinate the strike by 65 sandworm diggers along the central Maine coast. This strike bears a close resemblance to a disagreement among friends, but even friends have their limits. Take, for example, Mr. Ivan Fly, owner of the Maine Bait Company in Newcastle, Maine. Last year, he shipped more than 7 million worms to bait shops and worm wholesalers around the country. Worms, he says, are his bread and butter. For National Public Radio, I'm John Rudolph in Rockland, Maine.
You know, I could have sworn that was an April Fool's piece, except that it aired in June. And I'm certain that this is the only time you'll ever hear a reporter say, "Worms are his bread and butter."
Born down in a dead man's town, the first kick that took us when I hit the ground. End up like a dog that's been beaten.
On June 4th, 1984, the wait was over. The album was out, and by the end of that day, millions of people had it in their hands. Here's NPR's Noah Adams on the release of the Boss's album, Born in the USA.
Born in the USA now.
The album that went on sale today was 2 years in the making. Bruce Springsteen reportedly wrote 60 songs, selected 12 to record. Rolling Stone rock critic Dave Marsh.
I like this record. I like it a lot. I think it's one of the more comfortable records that he's made, just in terms of being able to listen to it. And I think it has two or three things on it that are among the best songs he's ever written, and it's got two or three things on it that give him a future that isn't simply banging out the same old stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that in a moment. First of all, though, the first cut on the album, Born in the USA, sounds great to me, but it also sounds as if Bruce Springsteen is doing Bruce Springsteen.
This song is really about being in Vietnam, and it's a very hard-hitting look at about being in Vietnam, which has the great lines and the immortal lines in a country that's still trying to deny the reality of that war. I had a brother at Khe Sanh. They're still there. He's all gone. That's the truth about Vietnam, for the first time I've ever heard it in a rock and roll record.
Now, you put this record on and you hear pretty much what you expected to hear. What is new about this effort from Bruce Springsteen after 2 years in the studio? What's new?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's what I would expect to hear. Number one, because Bruce has never allowed himself to record a lot of the lighter music that he writes. And so you get things like Glory Days, which is just kind of a funny little song, although it has a point, or I'm Going Down, or I'm on Fire, both of which express a kind of sexuality and a kind of vulnerability that he's never allowed himself. Granted, a number of the songs sound carved out of the same mold that produced The River, but I think it's inevitable, and I think it's also important that you give people some landmarks so they know where you're coming from as well as where you're going to. I don't quite hold with this British kind of idea that every record ought to be a complete departure from the last one. Glory Days is a song where Bruce is, well, in the beginning of the song, he's in a bar, and he's coming out, and he meets a high school baseball star that he'd gone to school with coming out.
We went back inside, sat down, had a few drinks, but all we kept talking about was Glory Days. Yeah, passing by Glory Days, and the way the young girls are, Glory Days, Glory Days.
Then he hangs around with a woman friend of his who was a high school cheerleader beauty, and who's kind of fallen apart. They have a couple of drinks, and all they can talk is about the old days. And then in the last verse, he says,
think I'm going down to the well tonight, and I'm gonna drink till I get my fill. And I hope when I get old, I don't sit around thinking about it, but I probably will. Yeah, just sitting back, trying to recapture a little of the glory of, well, the time slips away and leaves you with nothing, mister, but boring stories of. Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad desire. Tell me now, baby, is it good to you? And can he do to you the things that I do? Oh, no. I can take you high. Oh, I'm on fire.
Now, there's a really pretty song, a love ballad called I'm on Fire. You mentioned that.
I think what's important about that song is that for the first time in his whole career, Bruce is allowing himself to speak in a first-person voice and be vulnerable. And that's something that, you know, his whole macho man thing, which he's been condemned by everybody from now on down about, kind of evaporates on this record. Or it doesn't evaporate, but it certainly is compromised. And that's a good thing. It's an important thing, I think.
The last song on the album is My Hometown, and it's a song about a young boy and his father, and then the young boy as father and his young son. It's really a sad song.
To me, My Hometown, which is one thing on this record that reminds you that he did indeed make a record called Nebraska that was more acoustic-oriented and quieter and more related to kind of traditional American music, is also the song that brings you right back to what is maybe the hardest rocking track on the album, which is Born in the USA. And it's the one track where you're not caught up in the issues of 10 or 15 years ago, Vietnam, but where you're caught up in the issues of right now, of today. This line in the next to the last verse where the foreman says, "Those jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back," and all of a sudden it's not my hometown, it's your hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And just having to deal with that, having to deal with just that issue as part of this rock and roll music that people want to take lightly, is, to me, that's what makes Bruce the most fascinating person on the scene, because he won't hardly let anybody get away with anything.
This is your hometown.
For more stories on Bruce Springsteen, go to npr.org/music. June 6, 1984, marked the 40th anniversary of D-Day, the landing of Allied forces on the beaches of Normandy. NPR's Clem Taylor put together this radio documentary, which gives a breathtaking minute-by-minute account of the invasion.
It was just before 4 a.m. and still pitch dark as the Allied commanders of Operation Overlord gathered in the library of Southwick House in Portsmouth on England's southeast coast. Outside, a wretched combination of torrential rain and powerful gusts. The weather had already forced a one-day postponement of the invasion. Put it off another day and the rising tides would require a postponement of weeks, maybe longer. So the commanders listened intently to the weather forecast for June 6th. It was for marginal conditions. 7th Corps Commander, U.S. General J. Lawton Collins.
We had a final meeting, and it was nip and go as to whether we would go or not. I had to make the final decision, of course, and it was a great relief when he finally decided we were going to go.
Pressures to launch the invasion were enormous. For the past 6 months, the Americans, British, and Canadians had transformed southern England into one enormous arsenal. 3 million men, 16 million tons of arms and supplies.
There were miles and miles of rows of tanks, of M4s, M5s. It was just unbelievable.
William Donnelly of Detroit, Michigan, a second lieutenant, was a supply officer with the 58th Armored Field Artillery.
You'd come around a corner and you'd see 48 airplanes in a row underneath a line of trees with the basic camouflage netting over them, and several hundred tanks. And a tank looks funny when it's never been in combat because it's clean, has nothing hanging on it.
Dr. Forrest Pogue watched the massive military buildup from a different perspective. A sergeant from Eddyville, Kentucky, Pogue covered the invasion and the preparations for it as an official combat historian.
They were just packing case after packing case after packing case. And we knew, too, that once you got down the last 20-odd miles, that every field was filled with troops.
And many of those troops were young. This made an impression on Bill Donnelly, who had been through the African and Sicilian campaigns, a combat veteran at 27.
I was looked upon as an old man. I was known as Gramps and Grandpa and Pops. And I want to remind people that that was the war that people cheated to get in, not to get out. And most of them were 18, 17, 18, 19. 21 was considered, you know, pretty elderly guy. And they were all gung-ho.
Bless all the blondies and all the brunettes.
For those like Donnelly who had been through combat, those months in England were a welcome respite.
We'd go down to the local pub, which opened, I think, at 6 or 7. We'd stay there till it was closed, about 10, and rush the bar and order whiskey or gin. That's all they had. But we made contact with the local bells, and even though they were poorly dressed and poorly fed, they could speak English, and they were beautiful. Some very great attachments were made there.
By day, there was work, and especially rigorous training for some. Sergeant Bill Petty of Cohutta, Georgia, was with the 2nd Ranger Battalion.
The second day we were there, we started climbing 50, 60-foot cliffs. So we knew that we were headed to scale something.
Later, training would move to the Isle of Wight, where the cliffs rise 250 feet above the beach. Although the Allied troops had known something was going to happen, they didn't know exactly what. When they were finally given details of their mission, they were literally locked up. combat historian Forrest Pogue.
Once men knew where they were to land, they were not allowed out of those fields. In my own case, fortunately, I had been briefed in London and again at First Army and had read the whole plan at Fifth Corps. So I was allowed to go back in with the mailman to pick up mail. That gave me a chance to get a bath or two that nearly everybody else missed, because we didn't get another warm bath until along in August from late May.
On the other side of the channel, Hitler had been preparing for an invasion for years, fortifying the coast from Holland to Brittany. The German commander, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, who was convinced the invasion, when it came, would take place near the Pas-de-Calais, just 20 miles from Dover. The Allies did all they could to reinforce Rommel's hunch. They bombed the beach at Calais. They built phony docks, tanks, and barges at Dover. There was fictitious radio traffic, directing the movement and training of an entire non-existent U.S. field army. The real Allied plan was to land south of Calais on the Normandy coast. 58,000 men of General Omer Bradley's First Army would land on two beaches, codenamed Omaha and Utah. A 75,000-man force, mostly British and Canadian, would attack to the east on beaches labeled Gold, Juno, and Sword. And 24,000 British and American paratroopers would drop behind the beaches before the landings to fend off the inevitable German counterattacks.
This is London calling in the European News Service of the British Broadcasting Corporation. Here is the news. But first, here are some messages for our friends in occupied countries. The Trojan War will not be held. John is growing a very long beard this week. The long sobs of the violins of autumn. Les sanglots longs des violons de l'automne.
Those lines from a famous French poem were part of a code used to warn the French underground that an invasion was imminent. The coded message was overheard and understood by German intelligence, but it was never relayed to Normandy. No one knows why. On D-Day, Rommel had most of his 500,000-man force in the Calais area. Just 70,000 were guarding the beaches of Normandy. In the darkness of the early hours of June 6th, the first wave of Allied troops and equipment arrived by parachute and glider. The landing beaches were hit by air bombardment and gunfire from the battleships Arkansas and Texas offshore. Then came the largest invasion in history. 5,000 ships of every description steaming across the channel in a column 20 miles wide. General Collins.
We saw this tremendous armada all around us. It was a tremendous sight to behold, and also tended to give us confidence that we had the wherewithal to land and to hold our landings. There was never any doubt in my mind, and I'm sure there was no doubt in the minds of the troops themselves.
But there was also the sober realization that a successful landing would not come without casualties. Ranger Sergeant Bill Petty.
If you know that you're going to come in under fire and you're going to climb cliffs that are 100 or feet or higher, and then when you get to the top of those cliffs, you're going to have to take six guns, you'd be a little stupid if you didn't settle and realize, well, hell, you don't really have much of a chance of coming out of this, and neither do any of us.
The channel crossing was made worse by characteristically rough seas. Smaller landing craft were particularly vulnerable. The pitching and rolling, the bad food, the anxiety exacted their toll.
Everybody was bailing with their helmets, and, you know, people were getting seasick. I didn't get seasick. I did get seasick when a guy named Coldsmith threw up in his helmet and started to throw it overboard, and he threw it right in my face, so that sort of makes you a little sick.
And they were hours and hours in that rough sea getting the infantrymen into shore for the invasion at 6 o'clock, and they were also seasick. They could, they didn't care if they died.
German resistance was relatively weak on Utah Beach, where, as on the other beaches, winds and currents brought troops ashore at the wrong place.
And that was one of those exigencies of combat that worked out to our advantage.
General Joe Collins.
We landed some little distance off to one flank where there was no real prepared resistance. There were spots along the beach that the Germans had put in troops and artillery fire particularly, and that's what we were concerned with. we landed outside of the area that we were intended to land, so we got none of that initial fire that was planned by the Germans.
The Americans who landed on Omaha Beach were not so lucky. Undetected by Allied intelligence, an entire German division was in the area on maneuvers. Not first-rate troops, Bill Donnelly recalls.
But there were 6,000 of them up there. And they can shoot a rifle, and that's what made it tough. We only expected a few hundred people up there.
As it neared shore, the landing craft ferrying Donnelly's battalion hit a mine. The skipper was killed, along with a few men from Donnelly's unit. The fear of mines prompted many captains to keep their boats hundreds, even thousands of yards offshore. 10 small landing craft were lost. Amphibious tanks faltered in the surf. Of the first 32 launched, 27 sank. Hundreds of men, laden with heavy equipment and weapons, drowned, stepped on mines, or were shot wading in. The casualties presented Lieutenant Donnelly with his toughest decision on D-Day.
These bodies were lined up literally like cordwood, 2 and 3 deep, just shoes. And they'd bob around in the water, and some of these guys weren't dead. And then somebody had to make the decision. You got a very valuable piece of armored equipment like a tank. I don't want to get grisly, but somebody had to make up their mind whether, if you couldn't find a path through these guys, what did you do? Did you go down the beach presenting yourself as a target, or did you go straight ahead, you know, toward the enemy? It was tough.
The men and equipment went straight ahead. German military and machine gun fire continued. Traffic began to back up on the beach. Combat historian Forrest Pogue.
There would be a great number of men that were wounded and had had bandages put on, were just sitting there, dazed. And the picture you get there, of course, is absolute pandemonium, absolute lack of organization. People scattered all over the place, weapons abandoned, thrown away.
The confusion and the noise were just, we weren't even scared. It was so overwhelming, the noise and the utter confusion. It obviously was a snafu. Situation normal, all followed up, everything. The Navy's milling around, the Army's on the beach, the Germans are still visible up on the thing. They're supposed to be by the time we got in there, which was about 9:30, we were due in. 9:30, they were supposed to be in the first town. And more boats came in, and more boats came in, and they'd unload their equipment, and they'd get sunk, and the guys would get shot. The confusion was, and noise, and it was just bedlam.
One of the most daring assaults on D-Day was on the sheer cliffs, 9 stories high, at Pointe de Hoe. Under heavy fire from above, 225 U.S. Army Rangers scaled the cliffs to knock out a German artillery position. They used rockets to launch grappling hooks over the top. Attached to the hooks were the ropes and rope ladders they would use to climb the face. The Germans raked the cliffs with machine gun fire, tossed grenades at the invaders. They pulled the hooks from the ground and cut the rope ladders. It was the climb Sergeant Bill Petty had been training for. Halfway up the wall, Petty saw a buddy stop suddenly in mid-climb.
My guess is he got shot. I saw him, I was looking, because you're looking in every direction. And I saw him sort of lean way out from the cliff, and it's all almost like he was walking up the cliff, and then he just, you know, fell like he was doing a high dive, you know, with his back towards the ground. But he just seemed to float down.
By that evening, only 90 of the 225 Rangers were able to bear arms. Bill Petty was one of them. Little by little, news of the invasion reached London, and from there it was beamed around the world.
All day, Allied heavy bombers have been operating in support of the ground troops. They have encountered no fighter opposition. The action so far seems to have been almost too easy. The reputation of the German armies is still considerable, and there is no disposition to discount their power to hit back. There is no official admission that our bridgehead is free from concentrated artillery fire, but the general impression is that we are now in a position to start pouring the material ashore. The tanks and the self-propelled...
A bulletin, London. A naval officer just returned to Supreme Allied Headquarters from the French invasion beaches reports that all main points have been gained and that reinforcements are pouring across the channel in an unprecedented stream.
When night fell on June 6th, the Allies had landed 5 divisions, 154,000 men. They held all 5 beaches and had moved as far inland as 3 miles. Atop a hill on Omaha Beach, Lieutenant Bill Donnelly, his men and artillery ashore, sat down with a cup of coffee.
I was dazed. I was alive. I was unscratched, but I knew we'd lost an awful lot of men, and a lot of equipment, and I'd seen all those dead bodies down on the beach in daylight. But I said, we'd never lost anything before. We'd won every damn battle. And we didn't know how close it was that they almost did push us into the sea. We didn't realize until 20 years later, we read histories, that it was touch and go. We almost lost the whole beach.
American losses on D-Day were high. 1,400 killed, 3,100 wounded, 1,900 missing. Total Allied casualties, 10,000. One out of every 15 men sent ashore. German casualties, between 4 and 10,000. The first 24 hours of the invasion will be decisive, Field Marshal Rommel had warned. The fate of Germany depends on the outcome. For the Allies, as well as Germany, it will be the longest day. Rommel was right. In a few weeks of tough fighting, the Allies broke out of the Normandy beachhead and then swept through France. Paris was liberated on August 24th. 11 months after D-Day, Russian and American troops met in Germany, ending the war in Europe. Lieutenant Bill Donnelly and Ranger Sergeant Bill Petty were both wounded in Germany. Donnelly spent 4 years in Army hospitals. All four have returned previously to relive their successes, remember their fallen comrades, and contemplate their part of what some have called the most important day of their lives, Forrest Pogue.
I've never found a man that went in then or later who wasn't tremendously proud of it. And that's why so many are going back now. Anybody that was there the whole first week or who had any part in the whole of the war. This was a good war. This was a war we felt we should be in, that we would have been ashamed not to have been there.
That special long plane story on the D-Day invasion, reported and produced by NPR's Clem Taylor. For more stories on this year's observance of the 65th anniversary of D-Day, go to npr.org. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback from NPR.